What we're trying to do is slow down the circulation of the virus. You know, nobody wants to contribute to the well-being of the virus. We want to contribute to the well-being of our friends and our family.
Hi there, it's WAMC News Director Ian Pickus. And on this episode of the WAMC News Podcast, my conversation with Dr. Sheldon Jacobson, a professor of computer science at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He studies data science, applying it to public policy, sports, public health, and more. In recent months, he's been paying close attention to the coronavirus pandemic and how college campuses, with their nationwide spike in cases, should deal with it.
Their biggest risk is spreading it to people who you can have a bad outcome with. That's really the challenge with it. If you send people home, and I'd written an op-ed on this back, it's been probably a month and a half ago, before Anthony Fauci had even talked about this and the CDC had recommended it, is that you're basically sending infections away from a fairly homogeneous environment in terms of age to a much more heterogeneous environment where you've got more people who are at risk. And that is the challenge by sending people away. In many ways, if you think back in March, if we did not have spring break coincide with when the infection started to ramp up in the United States, sending all of these students back to large cities, for example, many people in the Albany area at SUNY Albany would be going to New York City. That was the worst place for them to go. But nobody knew at the time exactly what COVID-19 even was in terms of its virulence, who it was affecting. So in many ways, what turned out to be a good decision locally ended up being a bad decision globally. And that's the challenge that we're dealing with now, that when you have schools that have hundreds, if not some have thousands of infections, simply sending the students away, what you're doing is you're basically sending the infection away to areas that either have very few infections, which means it's going to populate those areas, or they already have a large infection positivity rate, and it will just make it worse. So that's the challenge that we're dealing with right now. The best thing that universities can do is basically hunker down and kind of get through this process so that, true, the students are going to be infected, give them the data and the information about it, and have them act in a manner that is in everybody's best interest, including their own. Because I don't think anybody would want to infect their grandparent. But if they are near an older person, they're near someone's grandparent. That's the problem. And we don't want anybody to spread it unnecessarily. So this is the idea that we've tried to communicate through our writings to give people a sense that this is a community effort. Everybody's in this together. Everybody should be, in fact, acting together for the common good. And in this particular case, sending students back to areas with their infections is not helping anybody.
What about the local communities where, especially here in the Northeast, there have been several college towns that have been very alarmed by the college students coming back, having two weekends of off-campus parties, and now they're worried that, wow, we've got cases in the local grocery store, and is it safe for me to walk down the sidewalk now that all the college kids are back?
And the answer is that this is the crux of the problem, that you have communities with people who are older, many at risk, and you're in a situation that if the students infect them, the students will walk away not even knowing that they're infected, while these people who are older are much more susceptible to bad outcomes. So the difficulty is that what do you do with the situation? This is when partnerships between the local leadership, the mayors, the city councils, the local businesses is so critical. Providing an opportunity for these elder people to do their grocery shopping at a time when the students just cannot come into the store. Creating an environment where the people are aware of the situation as opposed to walking blind into a risky situation. One of the things that I've advocated is that for the university leadership to work with the student leaders within the university, such as the leaders of the fraternities and sororities, the social as well as the academic groups, work with them and say, we need everybody's help. We need everybody to work together, because this cannot be a top-down process of getting the students to behave in a certain manner, which is adherent. It requires everybody to cooperate with each other. And this is what we've advocated and looked at. One of the other big things is testing. You know, the CDC has recommended that you only test people who are symptomatic or have been exposed to people. And this is bad. This is just bad advice. The reason they're giving it is there's not enough tests. But there are avenues to be able to access testing through saliva tests, for example, developed at Yale and the University of Illinois, where you can do rapid, widespread testing because the testing provides knowledge of infection status. And that knowledge is worth its weight in gold because when people know if they are in fact susceptible to transmitting the virus, they can act differently. Without that knowledge, we're all walking in fog.
Was it a mistake for colleges to bring students back for a fall semester without us having, you know, a vaccine or at least a national approach to controlling the spread?
Well, nobody knows exactly how to open a university. Some schools have done it purely for economic reasons. Some have done it because they truly believe this is the right thing to do. This is a multi-pronged, multi-layer approach to bringing universities back. So as a result, I think the first thing is you've got to be able to test people. And people are always concerned about the ones with symptoms. But we're seeing anywhere between 40 and 90% of the students are asymptomatic, which means that if you only test the symptomatic students, you're missing people who are basically contagious but don't even know it. So testing capabilities and creating that capacity for testing is absolutely critical. With that, you can actually get through this. The key is realizing that having a surge of infections is not the issue. It's how you're going to deal with that surge of infections. Do you have the capacity for people who are in residencies to isolate them? Do you have the ability to communicate people's infection status clearly and crisply? Is the local public health department working with the university and the community? These are all the factors. For us to simply take a one-size-fits-all, all-or-nothing approach, saying we're just not going to have in-person education, then we're never really knowing what will work. And we are discovering what is working. There are campuses that it's happening. There were surges, and now they're starting to quiet down because the universities are taking appropriate action. This is what we expected, and this is what I will continue to expect as we move forward through the semester.
What's happening right now in your system? What's happening in Urbana?
We have a phenomenal environment right here at the University of Illinois. We had developed in-house a saliva test, which is very similar to the one developed in conjunction with the MBA at Yale. And we are testing all undergraduates twice per week. We're testing all graduate students and faculty once per week. And we're now testing, I think in the last week it was around 55,000 tests were administered. That represents around 20% of all the tests in the state of Illinois and around 1% of all the tests in the United States just on our campus. And because of that, we saw an initial surge when students first came back, bringing the virus with them, but being asymptomatic, not even knowing they had it. And now we're seeing things getting much more under control. And this is exactly what we expected, and this is exactly what widespread testing will facilitate.
I have a question for you that it might be a hard one, but many colleges have advanced or sped up their fall calendar a bit, removed vacation weeks, and they plan to wrap things up right around Thanksgiving. Of course, that leads to the problem you've identified, which is sending the students back home a little bit earlier than they might normally go home. So are we just delaying this second wave here?
No. What that does is by you having movement of the students from one locale to another, what you're really doing is creating more risk. And you want to mitigate that risk. So by having the semester shortened and then moving online for the last week and a half after Thanksgiving, it gives the students the opportunity to then hunker down in their local communities and make good choices when they're with their families and others so that the virus does not have a chance to continue to circulate. What we're trying to do is slow down the circulation of the virus. You know, nobody wants to contribute to the well-being of the virus. We want to contribute to the well-being of our friends and our family. And the way to do that is to slow down the transmission of the virus. So by having students not come back after Thanksgiving and completing the semester online, it gives them a chance to stabilize their environment at their homes. At the same time, by the time we get to that point, campuses will have had the virus under control, so the number of viruses on campus by that time should be quite low if all the right protocols were put in place. So I think this is a win-win situation for everybody.
How much of this just comes down to, as you say, good decisions and compliance? I mean, it seems like at this point, 6 months into this pandemic, most people know what they should be doing and what they shouldn't be doing, but not everyone is going along with that.
Adherence is very, very tricky because you can't force people to do something they don't want to do. On the other hand, you want to give people knowledge and information so that they can make good, informed decisions. That is absolutely critical. That's why testing is so important. If someone doesn't know that they're positive and they go and infect two or three other people, then they didn't have that knowledge. But once they know that they're positive, they will act more responsibly. Does that mean we will get 100% adherence? Absolutely not. But we don't need 100% of adherence. If we can get to 80, 85, 90% adherence, we will suppress the transmission of the virus and we will see that the number of cases will drop precipitously.
Just have a general question for you. You've dedicated your life to data and data science. Is it frustrating to see our environment now where it's so easy for people to dismiss science and hard facts?
We're in a situation that people often will look for something that will justify what they want to do. And you can always use statistics to misrepresent information and data. As a data scientist, I look for what the data is saying, and I use techniques that could be vetted for everybody to, in fact, embrace. Frustrating, I wouldn't call it frustrating. It's much more focused along the lines of I have a responsibility to inform. I communicate through writing papers, through writing op-eds, to talking to people in the media, and demonstrating that there is some truth here. It rarely is it as extreme either on the right or the left where people talk about. It's somewhere usually in the middle, but there is a message to be shared, and I try and use sound science to do that.
What do you see as the end game for this coronavirus pandemic? Because already there's been a lot of debate over whether people will even line up for a vaccine once one is approved.
Very controversial issue, and it's one that when we look at it, you know, I'm seeing that we're going to continue to have a meandering of infections through the country with a slight downward trend as more and more people pick up antibodies, and hopefully it will provide some level of protection. At some point, we are going to develop a game-changing treatment, and I believe once we have that treatment, it will be more accepted by most people in terms of if you get sick, you're having a bad outcome, you're having trouble with your oxygen, given a treatment, you know, 3, 4, 5 days, a week later, you're fine. People are much more accepting of treatments at this point, and I believe that that is truly the end game, that when we get an effective treatment. We see that with HIV and AIDS, that we don't have a vaccine, but we do have an effective set of treatments which are available. Same principles hold, and I view that to be, in fact, the true game changer.
Last thing, have you looked at all at the fall election and what a prediction might show?
I actually run a website called Election Analytics, which is a STEM learning lab, which I run here at the University of Illinois, and we're up and live, and we're using polling data to try and forecast who's going to win the presidential election. A big unknown right now is the impact that COVID will have on how people will vote. And once again, just like we saw in 2016, you know, the last week before the election was the big difference between one candidate winning and the other one losing. We're in the same situation right here. We won't know until a few days before the election where we stand because the situation is so fluid and quite unpredictable.
That's Dr. Sheldon Jacobson. Thank you so much for taking this time for us.
Thank you very much and have a wonderful day.
All right, that does it for this episode of the WAMC News Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. As always, stay safe. Until next time, I'm Ian Pickus.